Happy Monday, and thank you for tuning into the Bulwark Podcast. I'm joined today by Andy Smerek from the R Street Institute.
Hey, how are you? Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming in, and sorry you have to deal with me and not Charlie.
Oh, it's an even trade. Both of you guys are great.
So
I'm only saying that because he's listening. if he weren't listening.
Of course he's going to listen. He listens to every podcast and make sure I edit him properly. Andy is the Civil Society, Education, and Work Director at the R Street Institute, previously served as president of Maryland's State Board of Education, and wrote a piece for us last week about the post-Trump Republican Party. And there's a lot of thinking about that these days. Is impeachment, while not likely at the moment, removal not likely at the moment, is on the rise. And some Republicans are beginning to think, well, geez, maybe the era of Trump might not be forever. And you wrote a piece for us explaining sort of a positive outlook as to why.
That's right. Positive for those of us who are who can't abide the president, or at least his behavior. And it really just came from my point of view that I think the folks who were doing commentary prior to 2016 completely underestimated Trump. And I think that a lot of people in the commentary class are completely overinterpreting the results of his influence on the party and conservatism in the long haul. So my view here is, at minimum, against the conventional wisdom, people would say maybe even more than that. But my point is simply that, yeah, he seems to be a big figure now, but in the long run, he's going to have a pretty modest influence both on the GOP and American conservatism.
Well, like Sarah Palin might be a corollary, as someone who, you know, seized the hearts and minds of Republican voters who maybe didn't like John McCain, and that's why he picked her. But, you know, today Sarah Palin's running a content mill, not an influence in the party.
This is totally exactly right. And I dedicate, I think, two paragraphs in my piece to this, which is not just the Sarah Palin phenomenon, but there are folks on that, non-presidents of both parties, who capture everyone's imagination and seem like they are going to cause the ripples in the movement for years to come. But it's even the case of presidents that parties love their presidents when they are in power. And then when that president departs, they turn their backs on that president relatively quickly.
I mean, look at Bush.
Look at George W. Bush. Look at Clinton. Not long after Bill Clinton left office, people were already on the left having misgivings about him. Certainly goes back to Ford and Nixon. Certainly goes back to LBJ. The only president of the last half century that I can really say had a long-term serious impact on the thinking of the party was Reagan. And as I say in the piece, Trump's lots of things. Reagan, he ain't. So just as a general matter, we have to, I think, moderate our expectations of any president's long-term influence. Parties and ideologies move on swiftly. And I think for the three reasons I give in the piece related to popularity and people and principles, I think Trump is going to have a modest influence in the long term.
You write, it's impossible to know which individuals will emerge as the GOP's leaders post-Trump, but we should appreciate how little fidelity they will have to the ex-president. Trump treats others as dispensable. When he no longer possesses power, many Republicans, especially those who've been insulted by him, will surely be glad to reciprocate.
Correct. So there are a couple elements here. One is, even if you look at the recent Democratic debates, when President Obama's name comes up, a bunch of the Democrats are willing to criticize him pretty darn quickly over immigration issues or other things, and Joe Biden is left standing up for that administration. So even President Obama, who was popular and is still loved by lots of his party, the people who are vying for the seat that he held are already saying, yeah, we need to move past that. So when you have Donald Trump, who is way less popular and way more polarizing, and has insulted time and time again the people who work for him, the people who are just barely outside of his orbit, why would any of these folks show fidelity to him? I think once he leaves, the door is going to close swiftly behind him.
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, earlier, I think a day before we published your piece, Hugh Hewitt had a post, a Washington Post item, basically making a kind of Molly Hemingway-esque sort of piece that, like, you know, the party risks permanent destruction if you don't stand by your man. And Hugh, of course, worked for Richard Nixon, so I can understand that's the perspective he comes from. But I saw that and thought, wrong. You know, I mean, if Trump were impeached and removed, and I just think of people I know in my life who are very Trumpian voters, are they going to sit home and not vote for Mike Pence? You know, it doesn't.
You're exactly right.
For all the hoops they've jumped through for Donald Trump, they're going to be like, you know what? This is a true betrayal. No, I mean, it is all about clinging to power.
It is. And let me just say one other thing about that. So I was born in 1976. I came up, like, my formative ideas or the first things I recognized about politics was during the Reagan era and then George H.W. Bush and the transition from Reagan to Bush. I just, as I was becoming aware of politics, I saw how quickly people who loved Reagan swiftly followed and loved George H.W. Bush. And I kind of thought it was natural. Oh, he's a kind of avuncular guy and he's conservative.
Voodoo economics, you know. Well,
well, so this is an interesting point. He even criticized Reagan during that campaign, but then he became part of the team and people loved him. But then, you know, in 1996, all of a sudden the Republican Party swiftly got behind Bob Dole. And then people swiftly got behind George W. Bush. And then people swiftly, now folks, forget this. People like to criticize Mitt Romney now and criticize John McCain. But when they were running for president, the Republican Party was behind them. The party and the people who were loyal to the party and the ideology quickly get behind who the leader is. And yes, Donald Trump is popular right now, but the idea that he's going to be popular and cast a long shadow indefinitely, we have lots and lots of history that says that that doesn't happen with virtually any president. Why would we think it's going to happen with him? Again, we're just overestimating, I think, his influence.
You and I were talking before the show about Trump and the grifters and the trolls. And, you know, the hangers-on are like barnacles on a ship in a way. And the question is, you know, what kind of hanger-on are you? And the trolls eventually always get pushed out, and there are always trolls, just like there are always grifters.
Correct.
But there are also people who for years have hung their hat on not only just being movement cheerleaders, but also being staunch advocates of the tenets. And because in your piece, you point out that, you know, that the tenets, the fundamental tenets of conservatism are strong. I don't disagree. I mean, that's why I still consider myself Republican, because I believe in those tenets, even if our president and many of his supporters, both in and out of Congress, have seemed to abandon a lot of them. I guess the question that I would have in the way of pushback is, Trump either, you know, is removed or resigns or loses election or wins election in 4 years and then is out of office. And you make the point that we have all these principles that we can fall back on as a party. We might have some trouble convincing a lot of people that we still stand by those, because you can't just run with total, like, the level of abandonment. This is a much further swing, I think, than George Bush and Medicare Part D and No Child Left Behind. This I think, is a much further swing of the pendulum in terms of abandoning traditional conservative views.
Agreed.
And I guess what I don't see, and this isn't necessarily, you know, your piece didn't have to answer this necessarily, but so many people, I think, are going to be on the wrong side of the coin if they defended this for 6 or 10 years. They can't immediately go back and say, oh, you know what? Free trade, really good idea. deficits, they matter. You know, we got to reform those entitlements, because that's when those entitlement funds are, you know, they're going to be running out of money.
Correct.
How do you figure that?
You make a great point here. And so I want to, like, lay the foundation for this, which is an initial point that you laid out, was that every single president has a tendency to push his party, often, always has to be his, sorry for the pronoun, so far, in a direction that a lot of the members don't want to go. So certainly with No Child Left Behind, a lot of conservatives didn't like that. Medicare Part D. Also during the Clinton administration, welfare reform, the crime bill. This is just the power of the presidency. People in the party, including lots of the rank and file, decide, well, that's what my leader says. I'm going to go along with that. So there's a long tradition of this. It is absolutely true, though, that Trump has pushed the party and folks who I thought were more principled in their conservatism way, way farther than I thought any president could, and many more people have followed him, including very people who I thought were very principled, who would never go along with anti-free trade stuff, or the terrible language, just the appalling behavior. So yes, there is a rule that people get pushed by their leader. They follow them. Yes, it's true that Donald Trump has pushed them, and they have followed way, way more than I expected. So I think some number of these people are going to be hindered in their future, or they're going to have a lot of answering to do. Like, why is it all of a sudden you believed in tariffs? Or why all of a sudden did you, after getting elected in the Tea Party year or saying you were part of the Freedom Caucus, why did you no longer believe in small government? Can you answer that? I think time moves on. Some of those people will apologize and move on. Time will tell.
Right. It's sort of, you know, the old saying, the market and the economy are not the same thing. The ideas and the movement aren't the same thing. So you'll appreciate this question that I have here. Conservatism doesn't really seem to be about ideas anymore. I mean, you look at what they're doing on the Hill And, you know, when Bill Clinton was being impeached, like there were like 100 some odd laws or something that were being passed. What other than defend Trump at all costs, what seems to be, you know, the ideas of the GOP? What would we run on?
Yeah,
we're not pushing anything.
This is a big part of the piece that I wrote, which is that so many of the people who have come up and made a name for themselves on the right side of the aisle during the Trump era haven't been idea generators. They're not policy entrepreneurs. They're not even kind of government sector leaders. They've made a name for themselves largely by being defenders of Donald Trump. And there are lots of people in the party who love Trump, so they think that there is value in people being loyal foot soldiers to him. That doesn't do a lot for Trumpism in the long term, because if its ideas are just based on Trump and he goes away, or those ideas prove to not be very smart, well, what becomes of these people in the long term? I mean, the question here for these folks is, why did they run for office? Did they really run just so they could defend Donald Trump? Don't they have ideas of their own? Now, I decided when Trump got elected back in 2016 that I wasn't going to spend the next couple years bemoaning or just trying to tear down everyone who was defending him. I thought, to your earlier point, that what we needed to do is make sure that the Republican Party and conservatism were rooted in and energetic about and just fired up to press forward with ideas and principles and policy solutions. And I think there's too little of that right now, especially up on the Hill. I think there are times that Marco Rubio is trying. Certainly someone like Josh Hawley, with whom I do not agree, at least he has this kind of Teddy Roosevelt kind of populist streak. And he was writing about this years and years ago, long before he came to public prominence. He seems to have a point of view on some of these governing issues. And one of the things I write in the piece is that we got to recognize that although Trump is dominant right now, whether we're talking about Sasse or Rubio or Cruz, so many of these people were conservatives before. They were formed in an era, whether the Reagan era or the Bush era, they were formed by 9/11 and welfare reform and other things. Yes, they're principled conservatism seems to be dormant right now. It's kind of gone quiet. They're being overshadowed by Donald Trump. I get it. But I have faith that a number of these people actually believe in things like federalism and localism and markets and capitalism and good behavior and civic virtue. Time will tell. We'll see. But I'm more confident that when Trump disappears, that these people are going to be more like their old selves than they are like the contemporary Donald Trump.
Obviously, when it comes to lawmakers, that's the game, right? I mean, you want to get people elected, and it's sort of a calculated choice. And you see how Mitt Romney is departing now and kind of sticking his neck out. And Donald Trump is elevating him. And, you know, maybe that could be a tactical mistake for Trump. You know, other people, I mean, Sasse is up for election, but there are lots of senators who aren't going to be up for election until after Donald Trump could, in theory, be out of office should he lose in the fall of 2020. The question I have is, and there's no right or wrong answer to this, but it's just an interesting thought exercise, is you look at the differing tactics that these senators who know that they don't have to share a ballot with Trump in 2020. Romney is kind of taking a little bit more of a rogue role, and others are remaining a little bit more quiet. Question is will voters reward them in those states? I guess you have to know whether Trump wins or loses.
Right.
I mean, there's a possibility that sitting on your hands in silence and hoping you can ride out the storm just means that, you know, your voters aren't going to reward you because they won't think that you stood up for their interests or stood up for their state during that time.
I think that historians are going to look back, or political scientists are going to have a hard time explaining the behavior of Republican senators during this era, because the political science, I mean, going back to the Federalist Papers, is that there should have been something about the 6-year terms of senators, the Republicans, that should have given them more degrees of freedom to disagree with Donald Trump. And I was keeping track of this. Who are the senators who were elected in 2016 and 2018, who are up in 2020? And I thought that having that 6-year window to, I mean, it's supposed to give you independence. Yeah. So I understand, even though I get so frustrated with Ben Sasse for not being as independent or as principled or
outspoken
like I thought he would be. But I give him the benefit of that. He's up for re-election. He's trying to survive. I get all that stuff. But the people who have 4 years, 6 years left on their term, why haven't they spoken out more? Why haven't they used that, kind of like Mitt Romney? That's one of the big unanswered questions of this era. And that, I mean, I got to be humble about this. Maybe they know something that I don't. Maybe their voters are just so in love with Donald Trump that they think that they're doing the will of the people. But it's the fact that Trump has been so unpopular for so long. His numbers continue to be bad. This impeachment thing is looming, and we don't have huge names even walking around Iowa or New Hampshire. I thought that at this point we would have one or two or three people putting their toe in the water about primarying him. It just has not happened.
Well, I mean, aside from, you know,
the
three amigos.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, their careers aren't really going anywhere were it not for this.
Yeah. It's not Mitt Romney. No offense to those three. Courageous as it is to stick your neck out.
I'm happy they're doing it. But yeah, if the question is who feels so strongly enough about the future of the Republican Party and is so turned off by Donald Trump that they're willing to risk a potentially fruitful another 20, 30 years of their career by going up against him. The answer so far is zero.
Right. And, you know, a lot of this, it's interesting as a former Senate hand, and maybe it's just the fundamental. I mean, we can go back to the 17th Amendment, which I think is a mistake. I know that's not a popular.
This is the direct election of senators,
yes,
as opposed to. So, yeah, the worst, other than prohibition, probably the worst amendment. I agree. I think there's something about state legislators having the ability to elect the U.S. senators that enabled states to have more power.
Yeah.
17th Amendment.
Yeah. And, the 17th Amendment would also be a boon. You'd have a bigger majority in the Republican majority
in
the Senate. But I remember after my boss was one of the few people to survive 06, someone called and said, you know, if your boss doesn't support blank, I'm going to vote him out in November. And I said, you know, there's not an election in November. And they said, well, next November. I said, he was elected last November. You wouldn't be able to vote for him, you know, until 2012. And they're like, what? And you know, and I'm like, okay, that was the precise moment when I'm like, the 17th Amendment was a mistake.
You know, I'm reading this great book by Greg Weiner, who writes for you guys on occasion.
Yes.
I think it's Weiner, not Weiner, right?
I think you're right.
Anyway, so he's written brilliantly for you guys, but also this amazing book, Madison's Metronome, which makes the case that so much of our politics and policy, like founders were so smart by embedding into our constitutional structure the idea of time, that as long as you give the process enough duration, you stretch it out enough, that it's not just that majorities will rule, cool, calm, reasoned, seasoned majorities are going to rule over time. And I keep waiting for the Senate to take that role during this era, especially the Republican senators who recognize, I got to worry not just about November, but I have to worry about the party. I have to worry about the nation. I have 6 years. I have to think about the office of the presidency. And I'm going to use this term recognize that I might be unpopular for a little bit of time. It just hasn't happened the way I expected. Maybe it will happen once impeachment presses on some more, but I'm not holding my breath.
Yeah, and I'm just, you know, like Charlie, if he were hosting and our internet service provider were any good, he would say he's just not confident, as nor am I, about the number of Senate votes on the Republican side being there for removal. I mean, a lot can happen, just like in the World Series, you know, two games, a lot can happen.
Yeah, I mean, we got to recognize, I mean, just going back to history, what was it, the Clinton impeachment, I get this mixed up, 97, 98, 99, something like that. In general, this was a party line vote. I mean, there on one of the articles, I guess, in the Senate, we had some Republicans who voted against removal. But we got to expect that this is going to be party line unless something pretty dramatic happens. And at this point, can you imagine 10 voting for removal? I certainly can't get up to 15. I can't get to 20. No. Can't get 25 yet, unlike probably in 74 with Nixon. Unless something happens.
Yeah, Flake has floated this secret ballot idea, and that's nonsense. I mean, that's just I'm very much against that. One of the things I wanted to ask you about, you know, because we've covered elected officials, we've covered the talking heads, you know, the role of the media has changed. Social media has become ever more pervasive and influential in our lives, and think tanks. And, you know, you're a think tank guy, and our street is not a conventional think tank. You know, it isn't, you know, one of these multi-story brick buildings, you know.
It's been around for 100 years,
yes,
right?
Yes. It's not Brookings. It's not Hudson. And I love the work you guys do. And we have a lot of R Street folks contribute to our site. And if you guys don't know much more about R Street, go to rstreet.org and make sure you check out their great work. But I wonder what I've always viewed the big, you know, established think tanks is sort of like AAA minor league affiliates for administrations, that when your team is out of power, it's a great place to be. And then when your team is in power, those people go and other people move up the ladder and they increase their scholarly status.
Yep.
And it seems to me that not a lot of think tanks out there, at least the big ones on the right, are willing to engage on heterodoxy with Trump. Do you think that this is a calculated choice not to get singled out, where they just want to maximize their influence to get money from donors, or, you
great
know,
question.
Or is something that could kind of harm them long term? I mean, in terms of young ideologues who believe in the principles, which, you know, you talk about being the bedrock of conservatism. You know, if you see that these supposedly super principled think tanks aren't rail, you know, sticking it to the administration for heterodoxy on conservative, you know, principles, why would you want to go work for them?
Yeah. So your point is a great one. Just to flesh this out a bit, the AAA affiliate is great because, I mean, obviously think tanks are their own thing. They're their own major leagues.
Right.
But if you think of a think tank as a public policy research organization, a lot of those people want to go and do public policy. And so if you're based in D.C., when people who think like you are out of power, you're writing, researching, doing podcasts, whatever. But then when your administration shifts, you go and work in there. So this has traditionally happened. It didn't happen so much during the Trump administration. There are some cases where some heritage people, a couple AEI people, went over into the administration. But a lot of them during the campaign expressed distaste for Trump, and Trump's team took notice of that. And then even if the Trump administration, and I can say this with certainty, reached out to a lot of those people, and a lot of those people said, no, we're not interested. So the breezeway that exists between administration and the like-minded think tanks has not been the same during the Trump administration at all. But it is curious, let me say it a different way, that during this era, I call it the wilderness years for people like me who do research writing, care about the principles of conservatism. If during the Trump era, especially Trump himself, if now is not the time for those ideas to take root and bloom, now is the time for us to be building up these ideas. It's why I started this fellowship program to work with young future public servants who are to the right of center. It's why I'm doing a bunch of research and publications on how are state and local governments putting conservative things into action. So I think that it's the case that there are right of center think tanks. Well, I know it's the case. R Street and AEI and Hudson, people who were thinking about what does the Trump era mean? What does it mean for the future? How do we have an influence now? How do we have an influence in the future? But it is noticeable that there aren't, it just doesn't seem like now is an era of ideas. Right. Which ideas are percolating that are coming up through the think tank world that are embedding themselves in the administration and turning into policy proposals or much less actually legislation hasn't happened all that much. My hope is that this era ends and then
it's been mainly judges.
It's been judges. It's been judges.
Heritage and judges.
Yeah. So I hope that the work that I'm doing, that Yuval over at AEI and Adam White, who's over at AEI, I hope the work that we're doing now is, not to push the analogy too far, but we're lying fallow and maybe like that we're developing these seeds, and maybe when more fertile ground emerges in the future that the stuff will bloom then. But right now, not so much.
I want to get back to that in a second. Do you think that... you know, you're older than I am. You've served in administrations and you've gone beyond just being the Hill hack. Do you think that it's sort of the strange pettiness of Trump world and its refusal to embrace critics unless they join by shooting someone like a gang initiation?
Yeah.
That fewer people are making that? I mean, because I know personally some people who were very critical of Trump, who weren't seeking to join the Trump administration, and then were asked and then only, you know, got partially through the process just to be rejected.
Correct.
And you think that's done on purpose?
Okay, so yes, to pull the curtain back for folks who don't know how this crazy parlor game in D.C. actually works, it is always the case that administrations, when they're thinking about staffing up, whether in the White House or the executive branch agencies, they look for people, obviously, who are like-minded with the president, so those people can advance the agenda. But they also want to make sure that the people haven't been publicly saying awful things about the president. It's embarrassing, and then, you know, the media has a field day with it. So it's certainly the case when I've been appointed to positions by two governors, Republican governors, and one president, and it is absolutely the case that during my vetting process, somebody asked me some question along the lines of, hey, if we were to do a search, is there going to come up anything that you said awful things about the executive? And I would say, no, you know, I may have been critical about some proposal at some point, but everything was kind of within the lanes. And that happens with everybody in every administration.
And there's a difference between saying, I think that this trade theory is bonkers and it's going to hurt Americans, and he's a draft-dodging bone-spur sack of crap.
Precisely. Yeah, so most administrations...
There's a lot of that these days.
So most administrations have tolerance for the former, which is, you know, it's a war of ideas. Not everyone's going to agree about everything. We're going to have some sort of accommodation for people to work in the administration, even if they disagreed on a small matter of policy. But because this president was so, let me be diplomatic here, so just different than previous folks, and he was just so polarizing, more people like me said more negative things about him and did it more publicly, like the famous national...
And there's Twitter. There wasn't Twitter.
And Twitter.
Well, Twitter was maybe invented at the end of the Bush administration.
Correct.
It wouldn't have been when you were probably being considered for a job because
that's right. It
was the end of the Bush administration.
I think I got my Twitter account while I was working at the very end of the Bush administration. Yeah, so they could check Facebook.
And you've regretted it every day since. No. Or MySpace.
Oh, I had no MySpace. But yeah, Twitter has made my life worse. Yes. So lots of people, National Review, Weekly Standard, lots of people wrote articles calling themselves Never Trumpers. So there was more opportunity and more examples of people saying really bad things about the president. And so the administration just, I don't know if they officially had a like a blackball list of like people who were just knocked off and were never going to be allowed in. Certainly that list would have been longer because more people said more negative things. And it does seem that because this president, for some reason, is so desperate for adulation and is so thin-skinned that he just and his team have no tolerance for people who are not fully on board. Like you have to kiss the ring if you're going to be part of this team. And
I think some people in between him and the people that they were trying to bring on are like perfectly content to waste government resources to bring someone to jokingly think about bringing someone on just to reject them for not being fully on board.
We have to look back at that.
It's not too far-fetched to think.
Right. Like that famous or infamous dinner that Trump had with Mitt Romney. Depending on how you look at this, I mean,
I wonder if Mitt had to pay for that.
Probably. but like, were they doing that just so they could embarrass him? Just say, oh,
maybe.
Just so we could reject him. And I know lots of people who have gotten messages from the presidential personnel office saying, your name has come up. Will you fill out this paperwork? Tell us everything, all of your Twitter handles and so forth, so we can investigate it. Lots of people have gone through that process, gone through a lot of work only to be rejected. And whether or not the PPO is doing that on purpose or they just don't know, I don't know. But lots of people have been willing to serve and either decided not to do it or were knocked out.
We should want good people in this government.
Let's
jump back to, you know, laying the seeds. Because I wrote a piece here at The Bulwark, sort of an open, I don't really like open letters, but I broke my own rule. And I wrote one to former Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker. And he's the incoming president, I think, next year of Young America's Foundation. And Young America's Foundation, for listeners who don't know, and we're talking about think tanks as pipelines and everything else, there are some people who get bitten in late high school or college and never do anything institutional. And they just love politics and they come to Washington. You know, they either come through an academia or they come through a campaign or they get a job in a politician's office through an internship. But a lot of people are, for lack of a better term, groomed by big GOP, like the institution of these kind of young youth organizations, College Republicans being another one. I was a state vice chair of College Republicans. But Young America's Foundation, and you see this right now with sort of rejection of ideas. And Turning Point USA, run by Charlie Kirk, used to be like big government sucks, but now it seems to be more about like Benny Johnson memes and owning the libs and liberal tears.
Correct.
And I wrote in my piece to Governor Walker saying, you know, and his son works for Turning Point USA. I said, don't go that route. You know, you have this kind of tired roster of speakers, some of whom are very discredited at this point. Dinesh D'Souza, Ted Nugent, Michelle Malkin, you know, people who young conservatives shouldn't be looking up to.
Yes.
And I said, you can turn this all around because, you know, you're not subject to any of these sort of pressures of Trumpism like elected officials are. You can just slowly rebuild this and get rid of let the memesters go to Turning Point USA, but let the serious thinkers come to Young America's Foundation, because, you know, while it wasn't perfect when I did it as a high schooler and a college student, you know, they'd send me books about Hayek and other things like that that I didn't necessarily get in my high school.
Yes.
And I think it's very important. And I see this as young kids reach out to us at the Bulwark and they're like, hey, do you guys have an internship program? And I hate to tell them no, because it costs a lot of money and DC has pretty intense labor laws and this sort of stuff. So wanted to see what you thought. I mean, because this is going to have and it's not entirely due to Trumpism, but Trumpism has infected Turning Point USA.
Yes.
And as a result, and they've been very popular, I must admit, is going to not poison a lot of minds, but they're not raising the kinds of people that I would want staffing my Senate office.
Okay, so this is my fight song. I'm so happy you brought this up, and at the risk of boring your listeners, this is...
kids are not all right.
Well, because we, the grown-ups, I'm, like I alluded to earlier, born in 76, I'm 43. Like, I recognized something a couple years ago that lots of people who were in big GOP, who were doing Republican stuff, seem to have lost the string on why we do what we do. And, yeah, they were in favor of being Republicans and red states and so forth. But when you would get down to these questions about, well, why federalism, why capitalism, they had lost that. And I think that we, the older people, have to kind of take responsibility. No one is born knowing what road to serfdom is or knowing what democracy in America is. You have to be taught. You have to be read. You have to read those kinds of things. And if you're not getting in college, someone has to do it. And so this is why a little bit of self-promotion. Like, if anyone has time to read this article that we're here talking about, I spend the first third of it reciting the reasons why conservatism is a thing, why American conservatism became what it is, how the ideas hang together, who the authors are, because I want to reinvigorate this idea that we are a party, a movement of ideas, that it is a coherent approach to governing. And the second thing is the reason why I started this fellowship program that I mentioned earlier is I wanted to get people together, promising state and local mid-career folks who are going to do public service for the rest of their careers, who have been involved mostly in right-of-center politics, but have not had a chance to read Hayek, to read Adam Smith, didn't have a chance to talk about why a letter from Birmingham jail is important, didn't have a chance to think about Seeing Like a State or think about Margaret Thatcher or think about some of the writers today, to pull back from the politics, get reintegrated, like their work with these ideas of subsidiarity, of localism, of federalism, of civil society, of civic virtue, of capitalism, of free trade, that these things aren't just, like I say in my article, it's not just a hodgepodge of ideas. These speak to conservatives' view of human nature, of how we work together, how we get the most out of humans, how we sand down our rough edges, that we are a movement of ideas that hold together. It's a philosophy. And we got to teach people this so they can then serve in the White House or serve in governor's offices or write smart things. It pains me to think that there are lots of people who are running other fellowship programs or speaking or blogging or doing podcasts who really couldn't articulate what Hayek was trying to do when he talked about why decentralization is important, or talk about why the Ninth and Tenth Amendment are important, or why the Federalist Papers said the things that they did. No, a lot of people just want to own the libs, and that's dangerous for us in the long term.
Are you, you know, the subhead for your piece is the optimistic case for a Trumpism-free conservatism and Republican Party. As I look around, I mean, I didn't go to Grove City College. I didn't go, I didn't go to St. John's, didn't go to Hillsdale. You know, I went to Catholic schools my whole life, you know, where we learned Catholic theology, and I went to Jesuit high school and college. So a little different. I look around at the kind of more bookish institutions on the right, not as much St. John's as Hillsdale and Claremont and all these other things. And you're seeing, you know, Victor Davis Hanson, the case for Trumpism, and you're seeing the kind of the bookish conservatives.
Yes.
Using this to explain away Trumpism. Is that a bad thing? And are you optimistic about that?
Oh, it's a great question. And there are a number of smart people who are working at Claremont and otherwise who are more accommodating of Trumpism than I think they ought to be. But they have read their books and they are doing their best. And I'm going to give them the benefit of the doubt. They actually, through their knowledge of political science or history, they see some connections that I don't see. I'm trying to be charitable here. But I do think that a fulsome understanding of what the big body, the literature of conservatism, has to teach us, whether it's Burke and Tocqueville, Hayek and the rest, tells us at minimum to be very, very skeptical of the Trumpian way of doing business. The other part of this, and I've gotten some flack for saying this, but I'm going to say it anyway, is that there are lots of people who speak on behalf of conservatism who, as I like to say, they've only ever been in charge of column inches. They like to write. They've never been responsible for actually governing or for being involved in the democratic process. And that gives them degrees of freedom, but it also doesn't do what Aristotle and lots of other people told us that public service actually does. It teaches us about other people. It teaches us to be prudent. It teaches us to think about the long term. And so what I've noticed is there are lots of folks who are writing glowingly about this era who have never had to serve, who have never gone to a county council or a state board of education meeting, who have never walked around a soybean farm with a member of Congress, who've never put their name up for office. My point here is there are lots of things about Trumpism, including his disposition, that simply do not fly with the real stuff of democratic politics. You cannot act like Donald Trump acts and have a nation that thrives, that have communities that trust one another. And so not only like this fellowship program that I started and the things that I'm writing, not only am I talking about the ideas of conservatism, I'm saying we got to get more conservatives to go and serve, to actually go at the county level, the state level, the federal level, and realize what it's like to have governing authority and all the stuff that comes along with it. And I think that, having run for office, having served in six different government posts now, I know that, those experiences humbled me in a way that I think that lots of these pro-Trump writers probably ought to be humbled.
Sure. And, you know, I mean, some of them, you know, like Andy McCarthy from National Review is someone, you know, who served as a district attorney, and folks like, it doesn't apply to everyone in the column inches world, but it applies to a lot of them.
That's right.
One of the things that I think about with Turning Point USA and the importance of your fellowship program, which we'll get back to in a second, is when I was a young college Republican, young America's Foundation guy, and I worked on President Bush's campaign in 2004, left college for a semester to do that. You know, all my fellow college Republicans, can you get me a picture with President Bush? I'm like, hey man, you weren't there for the door knocks. Sorry.
Yep.
But I learned a lot about campaigning. But when I came to the Senate, I learned that governing's a lot harder than campaigning.
Oh, for sure.
Can you think of a situation that I know what mine is. I'll let you go first. Where when you talk about sitting there in a government post and having that awesome power, even though, you know, you might not be the head of a board of education, you know, you might just be kind of a mid-level committee staffer or even a personal office staffer, but, you know, you still got power to bend people's ear and affect change, like sitting down where you just kind of realize, like, these people are counting on me.
I'm sure
there are dozens, but
there,
like,
are. I mean, I wish that we could bottle your question and like have lots of people who are involved, engaged in the thinking and the writing about conservative
the looking
politics,
glass moment. About, you know, you're stepping through the looking glass.
Yeah. So, the first time came when I was working for the state legislature in Maryland, and then later on for a congressman in Maryland, where whether we were talking about something related to like these fights on Maryland's eastern shore between the agricultural community and the environmental community about
runoffs,
like,
and things.
Runoff and then submerged aquatic vegetation and dredging. These weren't just like hypothetical issues to people. This was going to affect a family farm that the family had owned for six generations, or could affect the watermen and concerned about crabs or oysters. So being at the table in these meetings with the Port of Baltimore, with agriculture community, realizing that people of very different minds who care deeply about the country, but also like their lives and their livelihoods and their families depended on this. I didn't have the luxury of yelling at them and just like speaking Milton Friedman to them. Like, I had to be a responsible grown up and listen and say, well, we got to figure out the best way to do this and get the best science, but also listen to the history on these things. The same thing when I was on the State Board of Education, people would raise these questions about school safety and discipline and testing, and good people, all of whom care about their kids and care about education, wildly different points of view. And yeah, I could have like taken off my shoe and banged it on the table and called half of the people dummies and said the other half were right. But no, I mean, there's something about conscientiousness and prudence and accommodation that you learn only by being in that position. And if I had behaved like a lot of these folks today are behaving on cable news, you'd get run out of town or someone would wait for you after your meeting and probably slug you in the jaw.
Kind of binary choiceism, save the bay versus pave the bay.
right. I mean, those make for great bumper stickers, but when you're actually the one who has to make a recommendation to the congressman or go before the National Academy of Sciences when they're studying the effects of dredging, you got to be a grown-up in these cases. And I never would have reached the point I did now had I not been in those kinds of meetings and had to actually serve. It's just something about service and having that responsibility, at least in my case, that made me think and behave differently. Yeah. What was your instance?
So 2008, the auto bailout. Yep. I worked for John Kyle from Arizona, and he's on the finance committee. And he was opposed to the auto bailout, which is funny because now in retrospect, the money that we lent the big three, which was lending, granted there was some lost, but it was repaid with interest and has now been dwarfed by what we've given to the farmers for Trump's trade war. But I remember there were a bunch of people, many of whom were from Ohio, where I'm from, who lived in Arizona, who were retirees from Delphi. The way the bankruptcy was looking like it was going to happen, these people were going to get screwed out of their pensions. They're going to get pushed over to the PBGC or the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation, which is, you know, if you think that our entitlements are bad, you know, PBGC is just an indication of the future if we don't do anything about it. And I had to sit there and look these guys in the eye, people who were from where I was and lived in the state that my boss represented, who were getting hosed. And, you know, Sherrod Brown had this bill, and I think I forget, there was another sponsor of it who were pushing for something that, you know, my boss was opposed to the bill, and he wasn't going to stand for this. And I had to look them in the eye and say, you know, I feel for where you guys are going. I can't even imagine what it's like. It was very hard to be honest with those guys about where my boss put and said, look, you know, you shouldn't have been put in this position. You should have done a better job. And, you know, I don't think that what the Obama administration is doing is going to solve it. But I'm not sure that more government is the answer either. You know, I mean, what do you want us to take money from to fund this? You know, like I have to sit across from you because it's my job and I want to hear your story because this is going to affect you. But then that has a snowball effect. And where that comes from, is it from future generations? Is it, do we defund, you know, something else? And of course, with PAYGO, everything has to be funded. So
correct.
They didn't get there. They didn't get their due. And those guys got screwed. And even though I wasn't working for a member who ideologically was interested in getting on board with the effort to help them, still had a big effect on me.
For sure. And in a positive way, right? Like,
yes.
You're humbled about this and you recognize how many different people have equities in these issues. And I used to think that the big virtue of that famous speech by Theodore Roosevelt, like the man in the arena speech, was just about courage. But I actually think there's something more. It's not just like being in the arena is about like having a backbone and fighting for things. It's that by virtue of being in the arena, it teaches you things about yourself and about public service. And public service just doesn't shape like the public's business. It shapes the public servant, him or herself. And I mean, if I could tell anything, especially to this upcoming generation, when Trumpism ends, what we've got to really make sure we're doing is making sure this next generation of leaders simultaneously have been studying the stuff of conservatism so they know when you're faced with an issue about trade or about entitlements or about housing, you have a set of principles that you can go by. So we need to inculcate folks into like this, the intellectual capital that's been built up over time. But the second thing is we don't want people just who have ideas. So get people thinking about these things, but also get this next generation serving and having these formative experiences of negotiating and accommodating and trying to reach some sort of consensus. Those are the kind of leaders we need for the future.
Yeah, because not everything is a bumper sticker.
No. As a matter of fact, the most interesting and tough issues repel bumper sticker type thinking.
Yeah. Well, Andy, I've kept you a little longer, and you're going to be late for your meeting. So
that's all right.
Thank you for making the time for us this morning.
It was a delight, and tell Charlie I said hi.
I will. I'm sure he'll have listened all the way to the end. And thank you all for listening. I'm stepping in for Charlie today, Jim Swift. Read Andy's piece, "The Post-Trump GOP: The Optimistic Case for a Trumpism-Free Conservatism and Republican Party," over at The Bulwark. And Andy, if anyone else wants to find out, you know, if they have a young kid in their life about what you're doing, is there a place they should go?
Yeah, they should just go over to the R Street website. You can find me and my program there. We call it Civil Society Education and Work, but the website's nice and easy. Or hit me up on Twitter.
Sounds good. Well, thanks for joining us. And Charlie will be back tomorrow, and we will do this all over again.